Room, a moment of silence and with the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Get to our speaker, Ralph. I was told we're going to hear something special with Keith T, and I want to introduce Keith.
Greetings, my name's Keith, and I'm a grateful recovering addict and alcoholic. Wow, I've never done this before. Program of many firsts. What I'd like to share with you all tonight is something that when I was 8 months clean, I wrote, and it was basically a representation of what I received from this program. And to the old timers, I hope that you enjoy what I have to say, and to the newcomers, I hope you hear what I have to say. Title of my piece is, It's a Joyous, Gray, and Beautiful Day. Because I woke up breathing while harmonizing to the melody of birds singing, and I'm thinking, what's the reason that I'm feeling so joyous? Man, I must be dreaming. So I pinched myself, and it proved I was wide awake. So I jumped out the bed, bowed my head, and began to pray for spiritual fitness, willingness and forgiveness, serenity, courage, and wisdom to know the difference. Because there was a time when my mind was way out there. Mercy is a blessing that I've been spared. So there ain't no hesitating in saying my morning prayers. Got to show gratitude to the man upstairs. Because on a daily basis, I went through some crazy stages. I was truly living in a matrix and had the slightest if I was going to make it. I was selfishly degraded, and I totally underestimated all his capabilities. But when I changed, I elevated. I traded in my destruction for his construction. That's what was a promise. Yeah, it took a while to process. But as long as I stayed honest, he would garnish all my misery and graduate me from a boy. So this is my reason for radiating so much joy. You know, there was no sign of the sun on the day that I decided I was done. And you know what's crazy? The way I used to chase a high. It was because I never realized that I was higher than the sky. Naturally. And it's really kind of sad the way drugs had me. Yeah, they had me feeling crappy, but today I'm living happy. Let me break it down. The sky is so beautiful. Even on gray and rainy days, let's have wonderful parades. For AAs to celebrate the first day of sobriety. I can't believe I'm traveling this journey that I am today. I heard the thunder roar back in the day when I was dying. It was destiny that expected me to cherish the fact that I'm surviving. I am presently manifesting the possibility of flying and positively pushing persistently because I keep thriving. And I keep rising, and I keep smiling, and I keep striving for magnificence. It's so gray and beautiful today, and it's so infinite. I represent his glory, and it's meant to share these stories. So I'm telling my side from experience, strength, and hope. And I'll go broke for all my folks that's finally spiritually awoke by delivering this message to all my folks that just don't know. I am finally living in a sense where knowledge and sense, grace and goodness is what I give out. I gotta make up for all that ignorance I used to spit out. Now, there's no doubt that we will persevere as long as we keep God in here, lyrically, mentally, spiritually, and continuously showing my joy for this gray and beautiful day. It doesn't matter how much the sun ain't shining. As long as we're surviving, that's enough to keep thriving.
Thank you very much, Keith. Truly, thank you. When John S. asked me to host Ralph, I was flabbergasted, and thank you, John. I really appreciate it. Thank everybody here for letting me do this. It's really quite an honor. I love AA, and I love people that I really envelop themselves into the program, and Ralph is one of these people. Last night, my wife and I, just a real short, if you heard how we met, neither of us should be sober. I'll be, quite honestly, neither of us should be sober. It's like the anti-12 steps. But it worked out well in the end. And he heard the whole story, and this touched me so much. He takes off his glasses and he wipes the tear from his eye. And then he looks and he says, God had saved you, me, but he wasn't done yet. He had another one still to save. And that's my wife. And that's how he brings God into this whole thing. So I want to introduce Ralph.
My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, T, for those words. And thank you guys for your company. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Keith. I think I feel like talking. I already got an opportunity to speak with a lot of you this afternoon. That's what it feels like to me. You know, we just talking. You know, I'm not one. You know, I get the opportunity to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. It still blows me away that people are willing to sit still and listen. You know, it's still an incredible, incredible privilege for a guy like me. You know, and I don't take it for granted. You know, but still, long time ago, my home group, there was a brother that used to come to my home group. This brother's name was Brother, you know, curiously enough. And Brother used to say, when heart speaks, heart hears. I like a lot of stuff. I have an intellectual bent. You know, I'm a schoolboy. I share about that all the time. You know, I like reading. I like research. I like head stuff. I really do like head stuff. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, something about when heart speaks, heart hears. And I love the fact that in these rooms we speak the language of the heart. So typically, I don't usually know where we're going, and that's a good thing. It's usually a good thing. Because where I would like to go, given my nature, when we do the countdown, Sandy's here, iconic, you know. And then, but he's not iconic, he's Sandy. He's iconic, but God has done something with his boy, and I've been able to be with this man quite a bit. And he's not iconic, he's Sandy. He's an alcoholic, and he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But still, you know, I'm like, ooh, Sandy's here. And then you were standing up 46, 47 years. Bunch of people stood up with 40. Bunch of people stood up with 30. Bunch of people stood up with 20. You know, and this is me. You know, let me full disclosure. You know, I'm image guy. You know, that I'm style over substance, God. You know, I'm all front, no back, God. You know, I'm that guy. You know, really not interested in telling the truth, just really interested in what I can convince you of. You know, I'm that kind of guy. I'm the image of God. I'm the make you like me, God. You know, and so since I'm sitting here in the presence of some spiritual giants, you know, I'm tempted, you know, to impress you with my knowledge of the book and the program, drop some page line references on you, you know. Do that whole deal. You know, that's my inclination. That's who I am. You know, yeah, you know, let Sandy go back. Ooh, Ralph really blew it. Yeah, that's, you know. But really, no disrespect to the 40s. No disrespect to the 30s. No disrespect to the 20s. No disrespect to all you double digit people who really proud of the double digits, and so am I. But Billy, I came here for you. I came for you. I came for any of the people that were standing up here in that crew, in that countdown. I came here to let you know what this power has done in this man's life and what it looks like. I'm really clear on that. I remember sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, fairly new. Guy was standing up in front of the group, somewhat like I am tonight. Dressed pretty nice, hair comb, eyes bright, stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself, I know this cat ain't been where I've been. I know he ain't felt what I felt. And I know he ain't done what I've done. What can this lame tell me? So it's real important that I let you know that the man that's standing in front of you guys tonight is not the same one stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous some few summers ago. I'm going to share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, in the hopes that Billy, maybe you, and maybe some of your compatriots out there might be thinking like I was thinking. Man, I used to do the same things. I used to feel the same way. Or more important, I too want to have this thing. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I grew up in the heart of Watts. I'm one of six boys. We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room. Six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. And my earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic, and I did not want to be like him. Now, my father wasn't abusive, and my father wasn't violent. My father was an absentee drunk. Every other Friday, you knew he wouldn't show up with a check. My father got put out the house when I was 8 or 9 years old, and my mother proceeded to raise these six boys by herself. Now, we lived in South Central Los Angeles, which is about as far south as I got, but my mother was from the South, and we were raised in an old Southern Baptist kind of background, right? You know, took her boys to church, took her boys, walked them to school every Sunday morning. Check this out. When I grew up, you know, ideal family life was taken from the TV shows of the day. And the ideal family life that was depicted on the shows when I was growing up, I'm going to date myself, Ozzie and Harriet, Donna Reed, My Three Sons, Father Knows Best. And you know that wasn't jumping off in my house, you know. When you grown, you get something that's called perspective. And perspective works like this. You had a mom that raised six boys by herself. She was on welfare. My mother was on welfare at the time. I can remember as a kid. Refused to settle for that. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 8 or 9 years old and you coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon and you hit the front door and mom's is in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed. And if your name is Ralph, you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in the prison I've lived in much of my life. It's the biggest prison I've ever lived in. It's the prison I live in sometimes even today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. So I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. So, you know, I'm in this deal, trapped in what I think you think about me. So, you know, I'm growing up in South Central, and, you know, yeah, we didn't have a lot growing up, you know. We used to go next door to use the neighbor's telephone. First car I had in my family was the car I bought when I graduated from high school. Somebody in here might be thinking to themselves, damn, that was a hard life, blood. Hey, you know, dude, he grew up in South Central, grew up in Washington. I wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for nothing in the world. Wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for nothing in the world, so don't get confused about this. If you hear my brother's story, same household, same circumstance, same neighborhood, same mother, a year younger than me, and Ronnie, has a whole different way of looking at it. But for me, I wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for anything in the world. You know, I grew up with a house with five brothers. I never knew a lonely moment. Baseball was my game, and me and my brothers made up the whole infield, and one of my brothers played left. You know, I'm the kind of kid that went to sleep on Christmas Eve with all his clothes on because I couldn't wait for Christmas Day to come. Now, check this out. Mom's only had about $40 as a budget for these six boys. So, you know, we didn't get a lot. Chinese checkers, some dominoes, maybe Monopoly, maybe I get a glove. But in my house on Christmas morning, it would be smells, and it would be music, and it would be traditions, and it would be singing, and it would be family, and it would be anticipation. And I couldn't imagine being anybody but a young brother growing up in South Central Los Angeles. It was a changing time. It was a turbulent time, and there was a lot of changes in my community, and I was going to be a part of it. And I just couldn't imagine being anywhere else in the world. You could play football in the streets. You know, you could go up to it. Just, I couldn't imagine being anybody else. So I'm not here to report to you guys tonight that I'm an alcoholic because I'm from the mean streets of Watts. You know, look around the room. You know that ain't the reason. You know, I'm not here to report to you guys tonight that I'm an alcoholic because I grew up in a broken home. Somebody in here grew up with both parents in the house. I'm not here to report to you guys tonight that I'm an alcoholic because I'm a poor kid from the ghetto. Somebody in here grew up with a silver spoon. I'm not here to report to you guys tonight that I'm an alcoholic because I'm a little guy. There's some big guys up in here. I'm not even here to report to you guys tonight I'm an alcoholic because I'm a man. There's plenty of women in here. I'm an alcoholic for two reasons and two reasons only. One, when I take one, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. And two, when I sincerely don't want to start it again, I start it again anyway. That's it. That's all. I'm bodily and mentally different. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story, and my story goes a little bit like this. Every single one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually student body president or class president. I was a straight-A student. I was teacher's pet. I played ball. I made all-stars. On the outside, I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Yeah, I was teacher's pet. Yeah, I was straight-A student. Would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. If I just could have been cool, because there was a whole lot more currency in my neighborhood placed on cool than on smart. Because the cats who was cool, you heard one of them last night, cats like Mike. You know, they was the ones in the bathroom, you know, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters with them, you know. And they knew how to talk to girls, and girls were a mystery to me. You know, fellas. I don't know how you guys always knew the rules for this manhood thing. You know, because I didn't grow up with the manual. Pops was gone. I didn't have a father. And I felt like you guys always had a handle on this deal that I just didn't know. You know, it would be cats 13 years old. You guys would be talking about standing around talking about throwing down with girls already. I didn't know you were lying, but I would still be thinking to myself, you know. I be thinking to myself, damn, how come I don't know? You know, later on in life, you know, my crew of dudes that I ran with, we'd be clubbing, right? And in my crew, it would always be a pretty boy. You know, somebody like Terry, you know. And then you were a pretty boy in the group, and they always knew how to, he was a player. He knew how to talk to girls. And he'd get a girl in the corner at the club and be whispering, and she'd start giggling. I'm ear hustling because I want to know, what do you say to make a girl giggle? I didn't have it in. I couldn't make a girl giggle. You know, I'm 16 years old, and I ain't touched nothing, right? Not, you know. In Alcoholics Anonymous, that's kind of, it took me a while in AA to get comfortable telling my story. This is the first place I ever landed where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? Right? My home group at home, my first home group, you know, was 9604 South Figueroa Row. If you were in my workshop this afternoon, you heard me describe that a little bit. And my home group was in the middle of the hood, you know, hard guys there. And when I first landed there, cats would be coming up to the podium, you know, and they'd be sharing these hard stories. And I wanted a penitentiary story without visiting the pen to get it, right? But my story's my story. You know, I'm a schoolboy. I'm a smart, you know, that's who I was, and that's what, and pretty soon I got comfortable with my story, because check this out, I'm not willing to go get another one, you know, so that's it, you know, that y'all got to get what I got, you know, so I'm 16 years old, in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's kind of late to start, you know, because you guys be talking about when my parents were giving parties, I was 7 or 8 years old, and I'd be going and drinking, I didn't have it like that. You know, I never saw active alcoholism in my house. Now, my father was an alcoholic, but my father drank away from home. Then he got put out of the house, and my mother never touched alcohol. So I experienced the effects of alcoholism, but I never saw active alcoholism inside of my house. You know, so I'm growing up, and I'm a late bloomer. Now, 16 years old, ain't touched nothing. Now, I get a girlfriend at 16. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for some of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a little time to pass, told my other boy I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me, she said yes. Now I got a girlfriend. But Ralph don't do girls, you know. This is my official girlfriend. If you would say, who you go with, she would have said, I go with Ralph. You know, I had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend, right? Remember them old rotary phones? The rotary phone? Check this out. On my official girlfriend, I call her, and that seventh number would come around. Seemed like it would come back in slow motion, and terror would set in. You got to talk. It's the telephone, right? And I just hang up on my girl, right? Click. This particular night, go out on a double date. Me and my girl in the back seat, older partner of mine, him and his girl in the front, he driving. Go to a drive-in movie. Plastic cup of rum and coke comes to the back seat this particular night. Drink that rum and coke. Went down real warm. Rushed back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said. I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about me all throughout that book. And it starts talking about me in the front of the book. New friends, we have a chapter in the front of our book entitled The Doctor's Opinion. And there's a line in The Doctor's Opinion jumped out at me first time I read it. Men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. I recognized that first time I drank, because that's why I drank. You know, I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's how it showed up in my experience. I know a lot of people that talk about from the very first drink they were alcoholic. That's not my experience. That first night I took a drink in the back seat of the car, I didn't make a fool out of myself. I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over my girl. I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before. And that's how my drinking stayed. I would drink to go out on the weekend and party. You know, I graduated from high school in 1971, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. In 71, I was still just drinking on weekends, you know. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only the night of the weekend, but I'm drinking during the day to get ready for the party. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but after class, I just started drinking, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking and I'm smoking herb and I'm selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, smoking herb, selling herb. I'm doing other drugs. I'm doing it on a daily basis. And you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that worked for me was this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, didn't chase some women and get low to come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. You know. For what? We didn't have nothing to discuss, you know. 2013, you know, when I started, You know, in the late 60s and the early 70s, it was a changing time in this country. It was a turbulent time in this country. And in some ways, it seemed like a simpler time. You know, in 2013, you got to worry about transmitting, you know, AIDS and practicing safe sex. Man, back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. You know, I don't need to know your sign. I don't need to know your last name. I don't need to know where you work. I don't need to know who your mama is. You know, are you doing this the way that I'm doing it, you know? And that's just the way that I was doing it, man. You know, and so I'm doing the deal. You know, back in those days, no disrespect to our young friends. I'm not talking about new friends. I'm talking about young friends. I'm glad I grew up at the time I grew up. I'm glad I grew up in the era I grew up. You know, I'm glad I grew up at a time you would go to concerts, you didn't even have to know your neighbors, you just passing. You know what I'm saying? That's just the time I came up in, man, you know. So I'm at this major university and I'm doing the deal and life is in front of me, man. And you know, I'm gonna go over here for a minute, bring me back if I stop. I came to the program four times before I came to stay. Some curious things in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. We use a language, and even though I recognize the words sometimes, the way you guys use them is not the way I use them, you know, all the time. And so it's something, you talk about surrender to win. What kind of concept is that? You guys say some strange stuff, you know. And one of the strangest concepts is because I came around here four times before I came to stay. And one of the things I kept tripping over is one of the thinnest lines, but that thin line makes all the difference. You know, you guys talk about, you know, comparing rather than identifying. And I would always compare and I could never identify. And I would always keep going back, keep getting loaded. You know, I would read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read the big book just like I would listen to you guys share your stories in the meetings. I'd listen for all the differences. I read the big book and you have Bill's story in the book. I read Bill's story. Oh, older white guy. We don't have that in common. You know, Wall Street stockbroker, check out the way I handle money. You know, we don't have that in common. You know, veteran of foreign wars, I'm a Vietnam era draft dodger. You know, go a little bit deeper in this story, and he says there have been no real infidelity. Well, miss me on that one too. You know, so I would always point out all the differences. I do the same things when you guys got up here and shared your stories. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, somebody taught me how to read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members share their stories at our meetings. When you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their stories, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I asked myself those questions, I found my story. I'm at this major university. Right? You know, I'm with cats who were going to be playing on Sundays in the NFL. I'm with cats who we were going to be looking at and playing in the association during the week. I'm with people who were going to be business leaders in my town and in my state and in this country. I'm looking at people who will be future political leaders of this place, and I'm right with them. I'm right with them. So I'm at this major university, and just like Bill, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. He said something else. He said drinks started taking a more important and exhilarating part in his life. I'm living in the dorms, and I'm rolling with the big boys, and that's what we're doing, drinking what youngsters drinking. And it started being important. That Annie Green Springs, that Tyrolia, that Red Mountain Wine, 39 cent a gallon seemed like, you know, and we drink, and it's starting to take a more important and exhilarating part. Bill went on to say something else that sounded a little crazy to me. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, out of this combination of his thinking and his drinking, he would later forge a weapon that would turn on him like a boomerang and all but cut him to ribbons. I don't talk like that. You know, folk where I come from had a shortcut version. They used to say, trouble always start out like fun. And I'm at this major university, man, and I'm rolling with these cats, and you couldn't have told me. You couldn't have told me on the front end when I started off with this Annie Green Springs and this Boone's Farm and this rum and coke and this Southern Comfort and the you couldn't have told me it was going to take me to the places it took me. You couldn't have told me. at the front end. And so I'm doing the damn thing, man, and I'm rolling in the style that I think I'm accustomed to. I'm rolling with big boys. Somehow I make it out of the school, and I start working as a counselor for LA City Schools. And although I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquire, I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when alcohol was working. I'd buy a car, I'd make exactly 3 car payments, then come find it. Come find it. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. You know, I'm... 9 months behind on the car, though, right? Next 2 times, I didn't even trip. I already knew, you know. I'm the kind of brother never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. 0. No problem balancing my bank book. You know. Stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through it. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days when I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it. That's all. I party. And I can't tell you the day or the time or the hour. I can't tell you where I was or what I was doing when alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me and became a necessity. I can tell you that it did happen. Cold thing about the invisible line, somebody know, it's invisible. It don't say if you take this next one, you are now, you know. Bill calls it entering the region where there is no return through human aid. I like the region, you know, because the region is unmarked. It is not a boundary that says you are entering the region. No. In fact, by the time you know you're in the region, you're looking back, how I get in here? You know, cool thing about the disease I suffer from is by the time I have realized I got a problem and need to do something about it, too late for me to do something about it. Cold thing about the disease I suffer from. So I'm in the region, but I can't tell you when I got there. Anybody else play the regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous? The regret game goes something like this. If I only knew then what I know now, when they offered this to me, I never would. Yeah, right. Remind me of a story I like to tell. A story about a little boy named Johnny, his father, you know. And Johnny, you know, Johnny had a habit his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. Father goes off to work one day, comes home early, and, comes home early, opens little Johnny's bedroom door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father looks at him and says, son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind. Little Johnny stopped and looked at his daddy and said, well, daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses? You know, and... You know, I like that story because it reminds me of me and the life. You know, I see you going down, you going down, you going, I'm just going to do it till I need glasses. And it wasn't, you know, the big book talks about seeking the Lord companion. It wasn't long before I became the Lord companion. And we do not have enough time for me to share all the things that should have been signs along the way. The boy, you having a problem with this thing called alcohol. I got married on a Saturday afternoon in April in 1980. I had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor party till 7:30 in the morning, right? Me and my brothers. They take me home at 7:30. They pour me in the bed. They get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm toe up. That's one of the reasons, you know, almost 27 years later, I still love going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the reasons, you know, and it's not all of the, ooh, God, I'm understanding. It's some of it is just practical. I can talk shorthand. You know what I'm saying? I could just say, I was up till 7:30. I was toe up. And people in here are like, yeah, you ain't even got to go into detail. You know, one of them toe up where you throwing up stomach lining, you know, bed rotating and you trying to hold it. One of those nights, you know, I'm toe up. You know, so I go in there. And I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, right? And they give me up at, you know, at 10 and take me for this wedding at 1 o'clock. And I wobble and stagger in there. My then wife-to-be took one look at me staggering and looked at the preacher and said, okay, scratch the own vows, say the regular on his ass, right? So now my lines are cut to 2 words. We get into the ceremony. It gets to me. I get ready to say, I do. I tell, and threw up all over. Passed out. have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. New friends, if you're anything like me, when I hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I recognized the words that were being thrown around in the rooms, but the way you guys used them was not the way I used them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. So I needed some help with some of them. You guys are talking about a psychic change, this phenomenon of craving and this allergy of the body. And the way you guys used them was not the way I was normally using them. So I needed some help with them. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I lived it up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch, wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. And she'd go to the dining room table and pick her purse up and clutch it real close to her. She went back to the bathroom. And I feel as tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home, sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting here and they both crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, let me holler at you guys for a minute. I don't know about the rest of you. But I had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you your answer, right? Because what's the husband's role and what's the father's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, they came in my house several times. Each time I pretended to call 77th Division. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch. Two-year-old daughter coming outside pulling at my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. First time I hit my wife's purse, if you would hook me up to a polygraph, I would have passed when I told you, I'm not taking this money. I'm going to replace it before she knows it's missing, and I meant it. I meant it with everything in me. Took that $40, went out and spent it up, did what I do, came back looking for some more money. She had moved the purse. I couldn't believe I had hit the purse like that, so I didn't look for it too hard. And I said to myself, I'm going to replace this money before she knows it's missing. And I meant it. I meant it. I love Sandy's presentation. He and I are kindred spirits in that sense because I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes when you reflect on the history and the slender threads that hold us together, how close it is, it just blows me away. And of course, like all things, all big things, momentous things, miraculous things, in hindsight is when you can see God's finger. But when you in it, it's just you just in it. It just blows me away. Cat, 1934, dude ends up in the hospital, same hospital, fourth time. And the same doctor that treats him each time had seen him in and out, in and out, in and out. But this time in December of 1934, something happens. And what happens is so profound to do that when it happened to him, he couldn't even believe it. He said, I don't know what happened, Doc, but it feels like this one is for real. And the doctor, from the outside looking in, it was so profound. The doctor even said, dude, I don't know what it is, but you better hold on to it. So Bill, he leaves the hospital and he goes out looking for people like you and me. And he goes out and he's doing what it is that he does, and he's looking for people like you and me, and he's not finding anybody. He's going about it in a crazy way, but he's staying sober. And in a little while, some of his boys that he used to do business with, because Bill was a pretty successful business guy when he was being successful, some of his people saw that he was sober and said, we're going to put together a business opportunity, and dude, we want you to represent us in this, and you're going to make a nice piece of money. And they sent him off to Akron, Ohio, and his business didn't come off too well, and he found himself in a hotel lobby, and he got thirsty standing in that hotel lobby. And for the first time in his life, he said, I need to find a drunk not to drink. Who would put a thought like that in a drunk's head? I ain't never looked for a drunk not to drink. Blows me away. A partner of his had visited him the month before he was in the hospital. Had put him down with some information. And he was armed with this information. He remembers his boy had told him, you're going to need to work with somebody else. And through a series of divine coincidences, he's standing in this hotel lobby. I like to imagine he could, you know, Bill, he could hear the ice clinking in the glasses. Could hear the laughter coming out the bar. And it's calling him. And he said, you know, I need to find a drunk not to drink. Wow. Where did that come from? And so this hotel, you know, this hotel had a directory. And through a series of divine coincidences, he gets to calling these numbers. He gets put in touch with this preacher who knew a lady. And the lady knew a lady. And he gets put in touch with Ann Smith. And I understand your husband got a drinking problem. And Bill, Dr. Bob was in the doghouse. Tell dude to come by. And, you know, we'll see him tomorrow. I'll give him 15 minutes. Give him 15 minutes. And those two gentlemen met the next day. And that 15 minutes turned into about a 4.5-5 hour talk. And after that talk, those two set about working, looking for folk like me and you. And in about 2 years, they had found about 40 that were staying sober. 40 people. Imagine that. And I like to think, egocentric, as I like to think that New York hustler must have looked at that Akron physician and said, how are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his time? And they said, we'll put it in a book. And they put me in that book. Doesn't that amaze you? Doesn't that amaze you? For many of us, we were not even on this planet yet. Book was published in 1939. Put me in that book. Spent up all this money, and 2 weeks later, same scenario presented itself. I'm out doing what it is I do, spend up all my money again. And remember that idea of replacing the money before she knows it's missing? Those cats, something they put a line in that book, describes me to a T. We don't know why, but the alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force, pain, suffering, humiliation, weeks, even days ago. That idea of replacing the money didn't even come to mind this time. It got replaced with a new thought. I said, last time I took 40, came back and looked for some more money, she had moved a purse. This time I'll take all the money out the purse, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. And I was off and running to hit my wife's purse on a regular basis. She sleep with it up under the pillow, you know, and that didn't defeat me. Something about when you out and that phenomenon of craving, we don't call it phenomenon of craving till you get to the rooms. I just know that feeling is on me, you know. It's something about laying in bed with a person, you know, and you laying in bed and it's on you. It's something about knowing the money's just an arm's length away. And that purse be up under the pillow, and I let that regular breathing set in, and I let it set in for a little while, right? And then I crawl out my side of bed, crawl on her side. I come up under the pillow, and I come out real slow. Put the purse up in front of me, creep out the front door, jump in the Volkswagen, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. Might be Wednesday, might come back Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back. A note was on the screen door. The rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. Suitcase on the porch. I'm put out my house. I'm not my daddy. Went to stay at my mom's house, and over the course of the next year, my five brothers got put out of their respective homes. We all ended up at my mother's house, and we damn near killed her. When I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man that she married. And she would bring my daughter over to my mom's on Saturday afternoons so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take my girl to Disneyland, and I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand and just take her to the store and buy her ice cream. I wanted to sit my girl in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get, the look like this is my daddy and this is my hero, and the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I disappear. Sneak back on Sunday night when she was coming to pick her up. Could still remember some of them long Sunday nights, man, sticking my head around the side of my mother's house, tears flowing. tears flowing. And I'm sticking my head around the side of my mom's house. And I see those two heads in the car and those headlights backing out the driveway. And I be thinking through myself, through the tears, there goes my life backing out this driveway. And I've heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there. That's not a part of my story. Never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough. I got tired enough. I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. 2 days after I went to the Harbor Light, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that October in 1986, I was in a real bad way. I was in a real dark place. You know, I was in a real, real, real dark place. I had not looked at myself full face in the mirror for a couple of years. I couldn't believe what I had become. You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, and I was full of remorse and I was full of regret. And I was full of, you know, I just couldn't believe the things that had happened in my life. You know, I had risen to a place in my profession where I was working in management. You know, I was getting a salary position. I was on my way. And guys like me don't get second chances. Took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a gentleman was standing up in front of the group at that first meeting, sharing somewhat like I'm sharing tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that shit. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker that night seemed like he knew I was in the room. He was reading my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. And that speaker that night caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope from the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I went to. He described to me what I suffer from, and he did it in a strange way. Dude was talking about me, talking about himself. I had never seen anything like it. He shared that there's something physically different about it, and seemed like he invited me to diagnose myself. You know, I guess alcohol had its way with me so well, I was taking everything personal, but in a good way. It seemed like this cat was talking directly to me. You know, it's something physically different about me. Ralph, don't take my word for it. How many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to just stop off at happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to go over here to my boy CT's house for a minute? Ralph, what happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not my sponsors, not the oldest old timer. My experience abundantly confirms to me when I take one anything, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay, smart guy, if it's just my body, how do you explain stone sober, my car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday? Second part of this disease, the obsession that somehow, someday, I will be able to control and enjoy that magic potion I discovered all those many years ago. Somebody help me. Where's this control and enjoy coming from? Check this out. Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. Anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on control and enjoy? I can't drink because of my body. I can't not because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 describes it as a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental, and the physical are straightened out, that's what we do. Don't get scared. Somebody in here that's new, if you're thinking and if you're listening close, that's to probably raise your intent. He getting ready to throw the G word. I feel it.
cannot fool me. You can call it creative intelligence. You can call it spirit of the universe, czar, heaven. You can call it all that. I know what you're getting ready to say, dude, and you don't understand my condition. Yeah, all you church guys, you don't understand. That ain't going to touch what it is that I suffer from. I tried that before. I've been prayed on. I've been dunked. I've been all that. I'm done. Miss me with that, you know, that religious stuff. I'm not trying to hear it. Yeah, dude, standing up in front of the group right now, you 26 plus years sober. It's easy for God to just slide out of your mouth, but you don't know where it is that I come from. Check this out. I did not come up in here walking toward the light. I came up in here running from the fire. And if your ass is on fire, I did not come up in here seeking power. I did not come up in here seeking peace. I did not come up in here seeking any of the things that have become. I came up in here because alcohol had its way with me. Had its way with me. And I came up in here running from that disease. So when I sponsor, I don't ever try to promise what's on this side of recovery, but I do promise what's on that side of the way you live it. If you keep on doing what it is you're doing, you're going to keep on getting what it is you're getting. You might want to try this on for size. And I came up in here in that condition, pretty badly mangled. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one with the message of fear. I'm not trying to scare you. Oh, if you go back out there still kicking ass. Oh, if you, that ain't the message. You know, the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about a message that's got to have depth. You know, if you listen to me and if you listen and read between the lines in my story, you'll hear some stuff. In the early days, what I used to think of as my heyday, people used to look at me and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? I'd be scared of overdose. I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more up on, you know. So the message of fear ain't a message to the whole alcoholic of my variety. Big Book talks about a message that interests us is a message with depth and weight. And the message tonight's speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight is you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know where his little girl was enrolled in school and didn't know where his family was living. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake-up call to go to work in so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who came from a major university in this country, and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And you met me in that condition. The men and women in this fellowship, the fellowship I crave, met me in that condition, just like I was, and didn't ask anything from me. I came up in here a scared little boy playing at being a man, and all I wanted from you guys was to learn how not to spend a whole paycheck every 2 weeks, and I wanted to get my ex-old lady back. And I've been overpaid. I've got so much more than that. If you're sitting in here right now, you know, and you think this program is just about not drinking and you're just about not using, you're shortchanging the program and you're shortchanging yourself. I'm not knocking physical sobriety. Don't get me wrong. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it home with a whole paycheck. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might stop going to jail on the weekends. If you just don't drink and you just don't use, you might make it to work on Monday morning. But what this program has to offer is a whole lot more than that. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that can do anything but fail. What this program is really about. You want to see what Alcoholics Anonymous is about? Because sometimes I think we get confused. Alcoholics Anonymous is more than just steps on a wall. It's more than the book. If you think God is contained within the borders and the covers of a book, you're shortchanging yourself. In chapter 3, it talks about we tried every imaginable remedy. And one of the remedies it talks about is reading inspirational materials. Reading the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous without acquiring the power that's outlined in that process is just reading inspirational materials. You know, so that's not God in contact. What Alcoholics Anonymous is really about, because Alcoholics Anonymous is dynamic. It's alive. It's not a book and it's not a banner. It's alive. It walks and it talks and it shakes hands. It's got broad shoulders. You know, and you want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? Anybody want to see it? Because we are visual. You know, we are all this social network, all this stuff. People are visual now. You want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? Take a look around the room.
You want to see Alcoholics Anonymous. What this program is really about is about taking people like us, drunks and convicts and con artists and boosters and strawberries and tricks and failures as parents and failures as kids, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. This program takes people like us and it sticks us together in one room, and I stick one hand in your hand and another hand in God's hand, and we pick up our beds and we walk out of these rooms as mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's going to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. You know, I am so grateful that I landed in this place when I landed in this place, and I was given the gift of desperation. I was given the gift of desperation. I was here for my fourth time, and I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. Meetings became the high point of my day. I come from a real dark place. You know, I come from that spot on a Saturday night where you would find me at the inn, was in the vicinity of my mom's house, and I was walking the streets at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And in the mid-80s, there was as many people walking the streets at 3 in the morning as it was 3 in the afternoon in Los Angeles. You know, and I am so grateful I don't walk the aimless walk. I'm so grateful I sleep in my own bed. I'm so great every now and then, every now and then. Because I get to tell my story a lot. I was talking to Sandy the other day, and I said, "Damn, Sandy, I haven't heard your story in a long time." He said, "Because I've been telling a long time. I'm tired of hearing." I said, "I'm not. You know, I'm not tired of hearing it. I need to, you know, because when you do the damn thing and God does what he does so well, he does what he does so well." Bill called it roots grasping new soil. I'm not the same man in a different environment. I'm a different man in a different environment. Roots grasp new soil. Same man would be drunk. You know, a whole different person. I said to Don Pritz some time ago, I said, "Man, sometime when I'm telling my story, it sounds like a story about somebody else. Sometimes it don't feel, because a lot of times, you know, I just intellectually know it, but I don't, every now and then I still get the, sometimes a smell, sometimes a sound. Every now and then I get transported. That's why we work so hard with news people, because when you've been doing this, God does his work so well. He does his work so well that it'll feel like another story." And Don told me, "Ralph, that's because it is. That man is dead. There are so many problems." It talks about we were reborn. You know, that man is dead. Now, trust me, resting on my laurels, he can come up. He can Lazarus on you now. Don't act like he ain't up in there. But that man is dead. But every now and then, you know, every now and then I get reminded, you know, because the thing about this deal that we do and the way that this power has manifested in my life, you know, I've had the opportunity, I call them opportunities, the things I see as adversities in my life, God's opportunities for me to grow. I grow in the valley. Somebody in here is in a dark place right now. Just like mushrooms, you'll grow in the dark. Grow in the valley. You can grow wherever you plant it. You know, and one of the things, the way that God works with me, because he does his work with me, I am so grateful. You know, I look at a friend of mine right now and I get filled up. Stella's here and she's living here right now. And sometimes, you know, I feel like this big brother, paternal sense of, yeah, that's one of my girls. She's out here and she's doing the damn thing and she's sponsoring people and I had the opportunity and the privilege. Somebody like me. I came in here from, you know, and I had had some successes. I was the guy, me and my brothers made my mother proud. I was the first kid off my block to go to college. I wasn't used to losing. But when you get in the grips of this thing that I was in the grips of, I got used to losing real easy. So, and pretty soon, I had a new master. I didn't have a key to nobody's house. I didn't have self-control, man. And so I came to you guys. And you did something with me. First time I did a third step prayer, I'm going all over the place right now, but I'm talking about what you guys have done with this life. First time I did a third step prayer, did it with a group. I've had the opportunity, if you guys were at my workshop earlier this afternoon, I talked about this workshop my brother and this friend of mine started. And we had the opportunity to start going through it with some people and going through the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got on my knees. Blows me away. It blows me away. It should blow you away if you think about it too. And I said, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me. Check this out. I had a little over a year of sobriety. I wasn't much to look at. Check, I was not a vision for you. You know, I didn't know. Didn't have a place to stay. Didn't have a pot to piss in. But I was on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on fire for this recovery thing, right? And I got on my knees, and what came to me, if I'd have walked up to any woman in here talking about offering myself to you, you'd have been like, dude, keep it moving. You know, but I'm like, but I went to this power, and I said, I offer myself to you, and check that. He took me. He took me. He didn't say you have to stop lying for you to come to me. He didn't say you have to stop hoeing. He didn't say you have to stop tricking. He didn't say you have to be perfect. He didn't say, I said, I offer myself just like I am, just like this. Just like this. And he took me. And he did something with that. He did something with it. And I didn't know what was going on when he did it with it. I didn't know what takes place when we do meetings every day. If you knew Billy, this is what we do. I started going to meetings, and I started going with the desperation of a drowning man. And I started going to meetings till I wanted to go to meetings, and they became the high point of my day. I didn't have it in me. I met a guy at this meeting, and he's a guy, you know, I know people at Sandy's group see Sandy and this guy. But Sandy is too far out there. He's 40-something years. I couldn't get with that. But this guy had about 9 years, and nine would seem like forever. And he was a guy that when he got up and shared, people listened to him. You know, and I was at a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was fairly new, and I was sitting there, and they had a break at the meeting. And I wanted to go out and get some coffee, but I was scared if I went out and stumbled, everybody would look at me and laugh at me. And then on the other hand, I was scared nobody knew I was in the room. That newcomer thing, everybody looking at me, nobody see me. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes you forget how newcomers think when you've been around, but I was like that. And dude came to me at the break. He was leading the meeting. He said, what's your name? And I told him my name. He stuck his hand out. He said, what's your name? And at the end of the meeting, I don't know who spoke at that meeting. I don't know what went down at that meeting. I know at the end of the meeting in California, you know, at the end of the meeting, we read A Vision for You. And Bob Hunt said at the end of that meeting, he said, and after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers, I want my new friend, Ralph, to lead us in the Lord. Somebody knew my name in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody knew my name. And I started following this dude. And he put me in the car, and we'd be rolling places, right? Him and his boy. And they had 9 years, and I'd just be soaking up the stories. I'd be listening to them, and they'd be sharing. And they would be giving me living experiences of men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they raised me. And I didn't have what it took. You know, when people be coming to me talking about somebody asked me to sponsor him, Ralph, but I don't feel ready. And I told them, that ain't what the new person here. The new person don't feel here. You feel ill-equipped. New person here, no. You know, and I was, you know, this dude, and he was a heavyweight. And I know he didn't want to fool with me. But we rolling. He taking me places all over. But I know he don't want to be burdened with me. And I didn't have what it took to get another rejection, right? I'm that fragile, but I'm hard. I'm hard, but I'm fragile. You know, so I'm, so I wouldn't ask him to sponsor me. But I'm in this dilemma because I'm listening to everything and I want to get a sponsor because you guys have a sponsor. And so we roll in one day and I say, we in the car, I said, you know, I consider you my sponsor, right? He can't say no to that, right? I'm telling him where I've been. You know, I consider you my sponsor. And he just kind of did what you guys do that's been around. Because you already know. You already. And he just kind of shook his head and said, brother, we can do this. And he put my feet on a path to really go somewhere. And I started on that sponsorship path. You know, and I started doing the deal, man. I started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. I started taking commitments. I started doing something I didn't know I was doing. You know, I started doing the repetition in this program, and it's important. I didn't become an alcoholic from not drinking. That might have went over somebody's head. I didn't become an alcoholic from not drinking. I became an alcoholic from drinking. I don't recover from not recovering. I recover by recovering. Well, how do we recover? This process, duh. Sometimes people think, oh, they're talking the process and stuff. Now we're outside the meeting, they're going to really tell me the real answer. No, this is it. These 12 steps, this repetitive action, this training your feet. And you never know. The closest I came to getting low, you know, I have never come close to a drink but one time. And here's the thing. When I came close to taking a drink, I wasn't even thirsty. That's why I know when we talk about, you know, this is, you know, bottles were only a symptom. I'm 7 years sober. I don't know where this story's coming from. Well, let's just go with it. I'm 7 years sober, and I'm in a hotel room in Palm Springs. I'm at work. And I work in L.A., but we had a trial, paralegal at a law firm, and we had a trial in Palm Springs, so we had to rent a hotel, and as the senior paralegal, I went and rented the hotel, got a war room, and we won on the first day of this motion. And anyway, we won the trial before it even went to trial. And so we're standing in this hotel room, and Disney was our client, and the lead counsel at Disney broke out a bottle of Dom Perignon. Seven people in the hotel room, three partners from my firm, two lawyers from the client, their paralegal, and me. And we're standing in this circle with this Dom Perignon. And I wasn't really tripping off, oh, I ain't drank Dom Perignon. That wasn't it. But this idea of not being inappropriate, this idea of fitting in, this idea of not letting my firm, this idea of, oh, man, it's seven. And how will you explain stepping out this circle? All you have to do is sip. They don't want you to do anything but sip. If you step out of here, you clearly are indicating, oh, it's something wrong. And all this is going through my head. In the period of time that he's going around the circle pouring. In the period of time, what's the moral of the story? Train your feet. Train your feet. 7 years sober. I don't know what meeting I could have afforded to miss. I don't know what sponsee's call I could have afforded to ignore. I don't know what sponsor's call I could have afforded not to make. I don't know what hospital visit I could have afforded to avoid. I don't know which panel commitment I could. I don't know what gave me just enough, because I'm the scary guy and I'm the appropriate guy and I'm the what you think of me guy. And I'm on stage and I stepped out the circle and told Mr. Noah, hold on a moment. And I took my glass and I went to the sink in the hotel room and put water in my glass. And I walked back to the circle and I felt like everybody was looking at me like, oh, what's wrong with him? I'm not one that shares, you know, if it's uncomfortable enough. No. Sometimes taking the right action don't feel right. Sometimes taking the right action feel uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable for 30 seconds. I've been comfortable with that decision for the last 19 plus years. You know, but I didn't think my way through that situation. Sandy was talking about it tonight. It is so clear to me. That's the end. And I didn't even, this is the cold thing as I'm thinking about it. I didn't utter a conscious prayer. But when your life becomes a prayer, when you walk with your hand in the hand all the time, when you've been developing this spiritual muscle that you don't know when you're going to need it. Sometimes people say, oh, I hear people say that a lot. Oh, I know what step to take when it's needed. If you ain't been lifting no weights, you can't lift 100 pounds when it's needed. You got to be lifting before it's needed to be able to lift when it's needed. You got to get some. Just like physical muscle memory, there's some spiritual muscle memory that's got to be developed. And that's developed in the storm. I've been in three storms. I've been in this last one, man. It felt like I wasn't going to come out of, and I learned some valuable lessons. I got to kind of smile. Is it all right now? And every right now kept being all right. Somebody in here is in the dark right now. If he don't act right in the next week, if this money don't come through in the next 2 weeks, if this kid don't start getting his act together, while it's long-winded guys up front, is it all right now? While we sitting in here right now, and every right now, it kept being all right. And I get to the other side, and I be armed with something. What did I say in that third step prayer? Take away my difficulties, not because I don't like them, though I don't like them, but take away my difficulties so victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, that I power, that I love, and take away my difficulties because somebody need to know. Somebody need to know I lost a marriage 20 years sober in front of everybody, didn't have to drink. Somebody need to know you can go broke in recovery, didn't have to drink. Somebody need to know that you can lose a house in front of everybody and you the image guy and you didn't have to drink. And in fact, didn't have to stop, didn't miss a beat. You guys carried me. You guys carried me, the fellowship I craved. Not a fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been doing this thing over 26 years. You know, I often forget to share some stuff that people ask me about all the time. My mom is still alive. You know, I got four brothers that made it to this program. I got a brother, Ryan, that talks a lot, too. He's 3 months older than me in recovery. You know, Sandy is, you know, I'm going to have to tell Ryan, yes, Sandy asked about him. And, you know, he's a practicing attorney in the state of California. Went back and got his license as a result of you guys. As a result of you guys, my baby brother Rod has 25 years in this program. You know, my mom is still alive. We gave my mother a surprise birthday party on her 75th birthday. She's 83 right now. Her 75th birthday, we gave her a surprise party. And we were standing around, and it's hard to surprise my mom. She's a sharp lady, and we pulled it off. We pulled it off. And we were sitting around that night talking, you know, and I was like, Mom, what's your favorite part of it? And my mom said, Ralph, you know, because my mom was the oldest of seven. She took care of her kid, of her brothers and sisters, her siblings. Then she started having babies when she was 18. And she started taking care of us. And she said at the end of that night, this is the first time I've ever had a party. As a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, my mama had a birthday party. Wow. Would have missed it. That 2-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, 30 years old right now. She's a practicing attorney in the state of California. And when she went through undergrad and when she went through law school, a stepdaddy didn't put her through. A play daddy didn't put her through. A play uncle didn't put her through. As a result of what you guys have done with this man's life. 2 weeks I'll be on a plane, not doing one of these deals, going to Boston. I got an 18-year-old daughter who's at home who's never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time she never will. We'll be checking into the dorm. She's an incoming freshman at Boston University. I remember when we bought her. We got River a car before the school year was out. And she had a car, but she didn't know she had it because she didn't have a license yet. So me and her mom had hit the car, and I started giving her driving. You know, we started driving every day when I pick her up from school. And that first day, I know. And one day I'm rolling in the car, right? I'm in the passenger seat. And River looks over. You know, I share a lot of stuff. I share stuff with my sponsees. Men, don't trip. If you need to cry, cry. But I'm not a crying man. You wasn't supposed to put that story out there, Terry. You know, I ain't no crying man, but I am, you know. And I was sitting in the car, and my daughter looked at me, and she busted me. And I'm just, anybody in here had them grace moments? That you just know without a doubt when grace comes calling and I'm sitting in the passenger seat and I don't know why that day, I don't know why it came on me, but this is what daddies do. This is what daddies do. They teach their little girls how to drive. And I would have missed it. If you want to know what a spiritual experience, that's what a spiritual experience, that's what it looked like. That's what it looks like. If you're sitting in here right now and you're wondering, when am I going to have my turn? You talked this 5 minutes before the miracle. When am I going to have this spiritual experience? If you can reach in your pocket right now and pull out anything green on a Saturday night, you're sitting in the middle of the spiritual experience right now. I could talk all night about what this power has done in my life. He's transformational. He transforms. The things I see as problems in my life, he's used them as things for me to grow. You know, I'm a seeker. I don't do it right. I don't do it perfect. You know, the spiritual thing I used to think of was floaty, don't make mistakes. The biggest freedom I've got as a result of putting my feet on this path of seeking is the freedom to make. I ain't even tripping. I got a friend that say, ain't no mistakes. Two things happen, lessons and blessings. No mistakes. Two things, lessons and blessings. Most of the time, both of them. Lessons and blessings. You know, this power in my concept, I ain't saying it's got to be yours. I ain't even saying it's got to be right. It's just the way I choose to believe. And my concept of this power, the way he works in this guy's life, you know, God very seldom tells me, he has three, he usually has one or three answers for his boy. Yes, not now, or I got something better for you. Yes, not now, or I got something better for you. Don't be tripping. All y'all are sitting out there and you worried because I'm right with you. We ain't got no money and two. No, we ain't broke. We just in between money. Quit tripping. We just in between money. We just don't even trip. God got something. He got something with your name on it. He got something with my name on it. How many ready to get out? You know the high point of this? Where the sponsors at? How many people sponsor up in this piece? You know, isn't one of the high points of sponsorship seeing the lights come on? Don't you love seeing the lights come on in a new person's face? We're going to see some lights come on in Billy. But here's the deal. Here's what I like the most about this program. It's plenty of other lights we don't even see that we turn on. We're turning them on right now. Sometimes I like to talk about it because you'll miss it. Sometimes we miss what goes on at our meetings because we think it's only going on what's right in here. Every time I go to a meeting, check this out. Me and you, we're doing it right now. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some little boy, some little girl, getting ready to have mama come home. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we're doing it right now. I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come back. Every time I go to a meeting, we're doing it right now. I get to participate in some man or some woman getting ready to have a hell of a mating in their life. Every time I go to a meeting, get to participate in some employer that I don't know and could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee enter the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? I've always said I wanted to do something important and I wanted to do something significant. And I can think of nothing more important and I can think of nothing more significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever anybody anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of aid to be there. For that, I'm responsible. I take that responsibility very seriously. You'll never hear Ralph White say, "I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing." Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.